We are fortunate indeed to have this one Bob Scott, who will soon appear with the chamber. I will discuss with him after church the advertising rates, which we try to keep to a minimum here. We're going to need a volunteer in this church, a rather unusual volunteer. The person has to be short, very thin, and extremely agile. Somebody who will be able to go on hands and knees down this cove above my head to a spot where one of my careful listeners last week, fascinated as always by the sermon, noticed that a light was out. So if you wish to volunteer for a useful service, please let me hear from you. Congregationalists are fiercely independent people. They're very plain spoken. They're sometimes quite blunt. And I suppose most of you noticed this, but I was rather pleased that a congregational bulletin board out on the lawn in front of the church in Briarcliff, New York, last week carried the minister's message, which said briefly, "Frankly, dear Trumps, I don't give a damn." I want to say one quick word about my role in this pulpit before I speak this morning. I will be talking to you, I am always talking to you, about where my own lifetime of study has brought me in a never-ending search to understand the Scripture and the Christian religion. I do not for a moment presume to speak for everybody in this church. And so the things I say this morning, as well as the things I say on any morning, you have a perfect right to disagree with and to tell me how strongly you disagree. We are not a creedal church. We are a covenant church. We walk together, but we are independent believers. You have to fashion your own faith. It would terrify me to think that somebody believed everything I said. When you do that for any speaker, you have no faith of your own. So I ask you this morning and on every morning to listen critically, use what you can, reject the rest, and if necessary, pity me. My chief critic told me on the way home last week that I was very academic and dull. I'll try to do a little better, but I am still in my teaching mode. So listen. Last week in our series on the life of Christ, we talked about stories in which people were healed of either physical or mental illness. This morning, we're going to consider the other kinds of miracle stories, which represent Christ as walking on water, extending food supplies by magic, cursing a fig tree because it hasn't produced fruit, and turning water into wine. As you know, people hold very strong and differing convictions about how to read those stories. Many believers feel they must be accepted literally in every detail, or else the entire religious system built on the character and message of Christ collapses. Other Christians think that they should be read as typical examples of the way in which great lives were made even greater by adoring disciples in ancient times. Whatever may be the truth about Jesus of Nazareth, it is a fact that disciples of great men have always written up their heroes, partly from pure affection, partly in the understandable hope that if they made the case strongly enough, others could be made disciples also. We have clear evidence of this writing up in certain stories about Jesus. And we need to remember that there was no reason at all to discourage that. For a long time, the floating legends which were brought into the written Gospels were not seen as sacred literature to which nothing could be added. There was great freedom to be creative. For example, Christ very adamantly, on at least one occasion, refused to claim equality with God. When someone asked what good deed should be done to win eternal life, he said, "Why do you ask me? There is one who is good." Obviously, he meant God. And obviously, he also meant that he was not claiming equality with God. But that did not stop the author of the last gospel from insisting that Christ was, in fact, equal with God. In the beginning, he said, was the Word, he means Christ, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. So even though Jesus put distance between himself and the ultimate perfection, John deliberately puts him on the same level with God, and this is exactly the kind of unrestrained veneration which has operated in all times wherever people have been captivated by a remarkable personality. Even in our own time, a London minister recalls that when he was in India, an educated Indian student asked for time off from his studies because he said he had heard that Mr. Gandhi had changed a woman miraculously into a man. If that kind of story can be tied to the character of a great man during his lifetime by an intelligent student, think what might be added to the stories of a far greater man 19 centuries earlier in a material that appeared long after his death and in a country where there was no pressure to speak cautiously and no agency of any kind to insist on verification. It can be shown over and over that it is practically impossible, even while a man is still alive, to stop that kind of exaggeration. During the lifetime of the great Roman Catholic missionary St. Francis Xavier, no miracles were claimed for him either by himself or by his missionary companions. But after his death, at least a dozen remarkable miracles were recorded, including claims that he made salt water turn into fresh, that he caused an earthquake, that he induced a crab to return a crucifix that had been lost at sea, and even that he raised the dead. St. Francis himself admitted how hard he found it to learn the simplest elements of the Japanese language. But in the various lives of this saint, His biographers claim that he spoke Japanese so fluently that people thought he was a native. And they said that other nationalities present heard him miraculously in their own tongues. St. Thomas à Becket of Canterbury was credited with a variety of miracles, including turning water into milk, restoring amputated arms and legs, and the resurrection of a dead animal. Muhammad, some 700 years after Christ, distinctly, firmly denied all power to work miracles. But his followers wanted people to admire him, so they invented some stories and exaggerated others. And he was finally said to have made the sun stand still, like Joshua in the Old Testament, with having drawn water magically from a rock, like Moses, and with having fed thousands from a handful of food, like both Elijah and Jesus. The point is that the miracle stories are by no means unique to Christ. And the more one thinks of them, the less compelling they may become as witnesses to his divinity. Some of them, in fact, are so bizarre and so unlike the personality we get from his teaching that scholars have wondered how they ever found their way into the record. For instance, there is a story in Matthew which you seldom hear from pulpits because it has a rather disturbing element of the grotesque in it, and because Christ in the story seems more like a dazzling showman at work than like the deeply thoughtful man who in his desert temptation turned his back on just such tricks and said he would not do them. This story tells how Peter came to Jesus for money to pay the state tax, and how Jesus told him to go fishing and open the mouth of the first fish he caught, where he would find the required coin shining in the fish's mouth. For many Christians, thoughtful Christians, there is something a little shocking in a story like that, placed in the pure and piercing atmosphere of the Gospels and set over against the majesty of Christ's presence. It's like something from a carnival midway put side by side with a view of the Grand Canyon. Many find it hard to think that Christ would have used such tricks, appealing, as this one does, to the crudest levels of the love of magic. Many devoted students of the Bible have thought that such stories were added to the record by those who had only heard of the glory of Jesus from those who had actually seen it, and who perhaps knew no other way to show the world how wondrous they thought he was. Magic was the one irrefutable proof of God's favor in those days. Without it, Jesus would have been considered inferior to other wonder workers in the land, and they knew he wasn't. So not content with the miracle of how he lived, and what a miracle that is, and what he taught, a continuing miracle, they dressed him, some Christians think, you needn't, in the robes of a wonder worker, and put him on stage with performances which to this day present all kinds of puzzling problems. The story of turning 6 20-gallon water pots into 120 gallons of wine, for example, has a kind of showmanship and extravagance about it which has seemed to many to be foreign to the modest nature of Jesus. This story about enough magical wine to keep a small village stocked for quite a while is told only in one gospel, written at least half a century after the event it narrates, and presents us with exactly the kind of sign Jesus said in the desert. Remember the temptation story? He would not perform in order to win people's hearts. What really happened on the Sea of Galilee when the storm came up and Jesus is said to have calmed it? When he said, "Peace, be still," was he actually addressing the water as if the molecules of hydrogen and oxygen were sentient and could understand what he said in Aramaic? Or was he really, in the actual event, speaking to the frightened fishermen as if to say, "Stop fretting"? In fact, the colloquial phrase in Aramaic means something like, "Hush up," so they would not compound the danger by panic. And then what if, as happens all the time on Galilee to this very day, the sudden storm ended just as quickly as it began, so that years later, a generation and a half or two generations later, after the story had been retold 100 times and gained a little each time in the telling, it ended up not as the stirring but believable story of a brave man in total command of himself, but as the tale of a magician whose deed we may marvel at but can never hope to imitate. Not so well known is the curious story of the cursing of the fig tree, an incident which has caused careful students about as much perplexity as anything in the whole New Testament. And thank you, Miss Giles, for listening so intently. One morning, Matthew tells us, as Jesus was returning to Jerusalem, he was hungry. Seeing a fig tree, you heard it read by John Kochner, seeing a fig tree along the roadside, he went up to it, but there wasn't anything on it except leaves. Now, instead of saying, "Well, well, that's too bad," as we might have done, Matthew says he pronounced a curse on it. "May no fruit ever come from you again." At which the poor little fig tree shriveled up and died. Now, this version of the story seems odd enough to some readers who wonder why a tree should be blamed for anything, as if it had a mind of its own, and for whom cursing a tree seems about as grown up as kicking a bicycle for having a flat tire. But another version of the same story makes it even more puzzling. Because as Mark tells it, and remember please, Mark is always that first gospel writer who presents Jesus in a more human way than anybody else. Mark is forever being softened in his bluntness by Matthew and Luke and John. Mark, as he tells it, says quite openly, it was the wrong season for figs. But Jesus was upset with it anyway and blasted it for not having fruit when he wanted fruit. Now, I have a 50-page research paper at home that goes through all sorts of different ways of explaining that story so that it will make some sense. But in order to keep Jesus from seeming to act like a spoiled child, they all begin with the same premise. And that is that the story simply cannot be read literally. Somehow, whatever happened got garbled in passing from one person to another and wound up in a form that does no credit at all to the marvelous personality of Jesus. Perhaps the most important thing to say about these stories is that they have so little practical use for us. If the life of Christ is stressed as a series of incredible miracles, it may make us gasp with surprise and amazement, but it cannot serve as a model for our own lives. You and I cannot walk on water. We cannot multiply food miraculously to beat inflation or to feed millions in this world who starve. And we cannot predict fish with silver dollars in their mouths or raise a single one of our most beloved friends from the dead. So in one sense, at least, it becomes academic whether such things actually happened or whether they grew out of credulity and misplaced affection, because they are not repeatable in the lives of the most ardent believers. For that reason, I came to the point where I concentrated when I read the Gospels on the inspiration the life of Christ can have for me when it is seen as a life within my reach. It has no usefulness unless I do that. If Christ lived by power unavailable to me, then it is cruel mockery to keep telling me to be like him. I have to believe that whatever made his life superb is available to change my own. And I happen to think that is exactly what he meant when he said, to all of you who believe, I give power to become sons of God. I remember that at a certain time in my life, I wanted desperately to be able to preach like N.B. Hardiman or Will Oliphant. And that later I wanted to be a professor like William Ringler or Kester Svensson. These were extraordinary men with great gifts, but they were not creatures of another order of life. And so I believed that if I tried hard enough, I might be like them. But Superman was no inspiration to me at all, at least not after I was 12. I knew I could never defy the laws of nature and do miracles like his, so he became merely an object of fantasy. And it may be a startling thing for me to say to you, but I think Jesus of Nazareth becomes, for millions of Christian people, an object of fantasy. And not someone that we can seriously consider trying to imitate. I think Jesus can assume that same remote unreality for some people if we insist that the miracle stories are in all ways a part of sober history rather than the understandable result of the poetry of faith. Excellent Christian students have raised this question often. Suppose each violation of natural law were taken as literal truth, what importance would they have for us? Are we taught a useful moral lesson by the story of a walk on water? Or are we simply amazed by it? What do we do with it? Which has real meaning for life in the 20th century? The story of how a tree was punished for failing to deliver fruit? Or a challenging statement like this: a man's life does not consist of the things he possesses. What does it profit if a woman should gain the whole world but lose herself in the process? Now, you may marvel at the tricks, but you can't live by them. They exist in a world apart. You live in Christ by the spoken word. There is a single sentence in Luke's gospel where I think Christ shows what he thought of all wonder working as a way of authenticating truth. In the story of the rich man and the beggar, when the rich man, who showed no compassion on earth, begged Abraham to send the beggar back to the world of the living to warn his brothers so that they would not make the same mistake he had made, Abraham said, "They have teachers who can tell them their duty. Let them listen." But since the rich man hadn't listened, he felt sure his brothers wouldn't either. So he begged for a miracle. "Send someone back from the dead. I know if they just see something sensational enough, they will change their way." And Abraham, representing Jesus, says, "If they will not hear, those who have taught for ages what people should do, neither will they be persuaded though one rose from the dead." I consider that one of the most undervalued remarks in the whole New Testament. It says bluntly that we are changed by the wisdom of words and not by magic or miracle. Multitudes of people in all ages have been credited with casting out demons, healing the sick, raising the dead. One of my own students affirmed steadfastly that people were raised from the dead all over South America not too many years ago, and I see someone in this audience who heard her say it that night. But none of those people have had churches founded in their name. The church was formed not because Jesus suspended the natural laws of his Father, but because what he said was so insightful, so deeply and permanently true, so filled with the power to transform life, that the church was built on his word. You remember this line? "Whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, that person builds the house of life upon a solid rock. To this day, for millions of Christians, it is the miracle of what he spoke that makes Jesus Lord of life. When they discover what happens, when they truly hear him, then the only miracle that counts is known to be true beyond all argument forever and ever.